Gabriella, clearly there is only one sort of ident and promotional thing that we can actually focus on these days as we turn to your good self. For what exactly?
The weather. Mm. And today is a special one because it's hot. Lincoln has, the weather for Lincoln is highs of 35 degrees centigrade, lows of 19 degrees centigrade, and it will be a sunny day with a moderate breeze. So,
live from Gibraltar, with or without her faithful friend Frodo, it's time for Gabriella Peralta on the Midweek Drive Morning Edition.
So does that mean that actually it's hotter in Lincoln, England, than it is in Gibraltar in the Mediterranean?
Yeah, it is. We've got a high today of 28 degrees with a low of 21, so yours fluctuates more in Lincoln, but much, much hotter, 35. I don't think the UK's ever had 35 degrees.
Oh, I think we have back in the day, you know, probably 2003, 2004.
But, yeah, but enjoy the heat.
Why? Why would we? Why would we wish to enjoy the heat? Yeah, that's why we have an air-conditioned studio.
I mean,
that's
not the enjoying it.
You're not enjoying it, Emma?
Not enjoying the heat.
Oh. We see Emma already not enjoying the heat. Fergus, good morning. Are you enjoying the heat?
Well, where I live in my house, I'm in kind of like an attic bedroom, but I think it's not completely kind of sealed. So depending on the weather, there's either a draft or it's just a sauna in there. Right. So it's currently a sauna.
I see. Right. So no windows, nothing.
Well, I do have a window, but it's just
padded cells. straight jacket.
I don't know.
And there you have it, the tales of Lincoln postgraduate and undergraduate students in terms of how they're responding to a sunny day with a moderate breeze. Oh, well, never mind. Enjoy it while it lasts. That's the important thing. Okay, I have found a typo in the Gibraltar Chronicle online. I'm thinking, Gabriella, do I go? Well, I already have. Unless it's a deliberate thing, because I don't know, 24th of July 2019, when this was posted, over 20 speakers have been announced for this year's literary festival. The festival will be held from Movember the 14th to the 17th. Exactly.
But it works.
I actually wrote that.
Yeah.
Don't admit that. Don't admit anything on that basis, Gabriella. No,
I put Chronicle staff because it was a friendly, I edited it.
Chronicle staff. Maybe you could actually just check.
Calling me out. It was early in the morning. Actually, that was picked up for the print, so it's not being printed. Well, with Movember, it's been printed with November.
Yeah, I mean, of course, regularly know, there is a big campaign, obviously, for male testicular cancer and so on, that actually Movember is very much a month in itself now, really. It's like Stoptober.
Still a word.
Which is one of the reasons why I thought Gabriella would say, oh, it just shows how Gibraltar is ahead of the curve, and actually you working that into the festival.
You admitting my fault. But I'll change it.
Gabriella, if you start admitting your faults, you're never going to become Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, are you now? You know, so
it's that's you need a massive ego for that.
Well, is that all? I'll have to see what will be said by Richard Fitzwilliams in a few moments with respect to that. Okay, Emma, any questions or queries you'd like to put to Gabriella about anything really? Gibraltar Literary Festival, for instance. I mean, that's always good. It's taking place in Movember.
I'd like to know about the literary festival, but first can I ask how Frodo is?
He's good. Well, he's been sick all week. Last week. So my mum had a great time taking care of both my dad and Frodo, who both got sick. We don't know if it was a human...
Do they share the same food?
Dog. No. But a human dog sickness, because they were both throwing up. Yeah. So they've both been cured, so now they're fine.
That's good. I mean,
my mom couldn't stand having both of them for a few days in the house and waking up at God knows what time in the morning because Frodo was throwing up. So
Now, obviously, when you say throwing up, and I appreciate it's 7.5 minutes almost past 8 o'clock, are we talking projectile vomit here? Are we talking exorcism kind of level of stuff here?
I didn't get those full details. Yeah.
Was his head spinning around frequently? You know, because that's obviously a sort of a classic sign of demonic possession.
Frodo doesn't do that, neither does my dad, actually.
No.
But no, I've seen Frodo throw up plenty of times in my life, and he does this thing where he walks. So he just likes to, instead of just in one area, just across the whole house, you know.
He walks.
Yeah.
He walks while throwing up, you know. Just spread it out the whole house.
So like pizza colour
pavement. The amount of times I've had to clean up after him. He's a sensitive dog.
Oh, of course. Exactly.
Walked into a room and I've seen him walking.
Vomiting over the place. Yeah.
It's awful. It's not something that people want to know, to be honest, on the radio.
But at the same time, I suppose you could say it's a reaction to our political situation at present. So, you know, it's just thought. Maybe he should stand for Parliament. But still, life continues. Fergus, any thoughts from yourself that you want to share with Gabriella?
Well, I suppose I should ask about the Literary Fest, really.
Yeah, good point. You see, I was wondering if you'd pick that little bone. See what I did there? Bone that I threw out. And he did. It's Lord Patton who's the star man, isn't it?
Yeah, Governor's Lecture, Lord Patton. Mm-hmm. We've got a lady called Paola for the Gibraltar Lecture. There's Diana Moran.
The Green Goddess. Recently featured, of course, on Siren Radio's Midweek Drive Morning Edition. So that's all great from that point of view. Do you know she's 80 years of age, exactly.
Oh,
exactly, yeah. So the kind of evergreen goddess as opposed to just the green goddess from this point of view. Gavin Esler is there, I see, award-winning television and radio broadcaster, which is excellent. And, of course, you've got Tim Bentinck, best known as the voice of David Archer in the BBC radio series Wagoner's Walk. No, The Archers. Threw that in there. Nobody remembers Wagoner's Walk. It used to be a kind of radio two equivalent to The Archers, but didn't quite have the longevity that The Archers actually used to have. Still, we'll find out more about the Gibraltar Literary Festival as the days and weeks proceed, obviously. Because gone till November. Wycliffe Jean, exactly. Or Movember, exactly. But we have indeed, as Fergus will attest to, been just eulogising about the joy and excitement about the Lincoln Literary Festival, of course, Lincoln Book Festival, which takes place end of September.
We had the chair on yesterday.
We did, yes. And next week we'll actually have the table and the settee. So, Phil Hamlin Williams, who is probably downloading the programme even as we speak, because it's online if you didn't quite catch it. Emma, I think it's time to deliver those last two questions.
Okay, yeah. So, Gabriella, did you have an interesting telephonic link with us today?
I did, thank you.
And will you be joining us again next week?
Yep, hopefully so.
Great.
King of beasts with quite so little hair.
I'm gonna be the main event like the king was before. I'm brushing up, I'm looking down, I'm working on my
board. Thus far, a rather uninspiring thing.
Oh, I just can't wait to be king.
You've run a long way to go, young master, if you think.
No one's saying do this.
Now, when I said that,
no one's saying be there.
What?
No one's saying stop that.
What you don't
no one's saying see here.
Now see here.
He don't run around all day.
Well, that's definitely out. Count me out! Out of service, out of Africa, I wouldn't hang about. This child is getting wildly out of wing.
Oh, I just can't wait to be king. Everybody look left. Everybody look right. Everywhere you look, I'm standing.
Minister's Boris Johnson there with his theme tune. And of course, having met Her Majesty yesterday, it'll only be a matter of time, Boris, before we actually do have King Boris of the little small country of England. Nice to see that he's already broken royal protocol, Richard Fitzwilliams, by actually already informing us what Her Majesty talked to him about. Brilliant.
Yes, sir, he really shouldn't do that. And I mean, we had the previous... No, but I mean, it isn't a joke. The trouble was, I mean, this brings to mind quite recently David Cameron saying to the mayor of New York, Mayor Bloomberg, and it was picked up, the Queen purred down the line. Yeah, this was after the Scottish referendum of 2014. Mm-hmm. But I mean, the things have reached levels whereby, I mean, you couldn't have made a lot of what has happened up.
We talked at length about this issue on the Midweek Drive yesterday, so I'll just actually summarise some of David Hughes's summary in the eye with some of the thoughts of some of our colleagues in politics. Plaid Cymru's leader at Westminster, Liz Saville-Roberts, said that the victory of Clown Mr Johnson was a gift to the cause of Welsh independence, which she said was now inevitable. The Conservative Party has just thrown the UK out of the frying pan and into the fire. The new Liberal Democrat leader, Jo Swinson, said Boris Johnson has finally got his hands on his keys to number 10, but he's shown time and time again that he isn't fit to be the Prime Minister of our country, whether it's throwing people under the bus or writing a lie on the side of one. Britain deserves better than Boris Johnson. And, of course, the Shadow Chancellor, John McDonnell, wrote on social media, this first Johnson speech is excruciatingly and embarrassingly underwhelming. It was like an ill-prepared afternoon speech at the local golf club. I could go on.
Well, I have to say, as somebody who is a staunch Remainer, if it's possible to be such a thing, I mean, I would make a couple of points. Firstly, Boris Johnson's speech was precisely what I would like to have seen had it been for the other side. I mean, had he talked like that about remaining and the positive features of it. And also, one odd thing, though, regarding Joe Swinton's comment, apparently, and I can't explain why, not good timing, the Lib Dems, who've got, I would have thought, the perfect opportunity of picking up the centre ground, given what's happening. She said, apparently, she wouldn't accept a second referendum result if it still resulted in a vote for leave. That's a very strange point of view.
Finally, not to be outdone, obviously, in full balance, the Green Party's leader in the Commons, Caroline Lucas, said around 100,000 Tory party members have inflicted inflicted on us a Prime Minister with a record of bigotry, racism, lying and incompetence. This is not democracy. And I'll add Anna Soubry, a former colleague, of course, of Mr Johnson, now, of course, in charge of Change UK. It is a very bleak day for our country. It's as stark as that. So all's well with the world then, isn't it, Richard? Really?
It is indeed, it is indeed. I have to say, I never understood why Change UK formed. I'd have thought they were much better off. I mean, no splinter party, it's practically impossible. I mean, one remembers the Gang of Four, you remember that, what happened to them. I mean, no, splinter parties simply don't flourish in a country which doesn't have proportional representation, I happen to believe. Granted, it's an unfair system that our first-past-the-post system does at least allow a political party to put a programme to the electorate which has some chance, unlike, say, Italy or Israel, of actually becoming law. I would prefer our system, but there are obvious problems with it. We can see now absolute... Well, I mean,
we... But, Richard, you are in New York. You should know, as the President of the United States actually said, we've got what we wanted because we love him over here. You know, we do. We absolutely think he's great. It's little Trump. Little Trump, big Trump. It's wonderful.
Well, I mean, that's just getting to levels where... I mean, if you want to do harm to someone whom you like, perhaps he's... But insofar as that was noticed, because, I mean, if you actually look at the seismic change in politics that occurred yesterday, for how long we simply don't know, I don't think most people will greatly care what Donald Trump thinks. I think that I would swiftly escape to New York from whence I recently come, and I wish I was meditating in front of that lovely fountain and that beautiful courtyard in the Frick, because there you have a series of masterpieces, the Boucher Room, the Fragonard Room, some splendid Holbeins, some absolutely glorious Vermeers. Wouldn't you prefer to to be there, perhaps.
I'm still looking to see, as we were talking about yesterday, and I'll close with this particular point, whether indeed Mr. Johnson will actually beat George Canning's record of the shortest serving Prime Minister, who of course lasted 119 days back in 1827. Emma, you remember that well, of course, 1827, I think.
Oh, yeah, of course.
What did Canning, insofar as he achieved anything or did anything, what did he do?
He died of the flu. Anyway.
I wasn't sure. I really wasn't. I'm trying to place it because it's just before the Duke of Wellington's disastrous administration. I know that, but I didn't. I see he got flu. Well, as Talleyrand said, when a diplomat died during important negotiations, what did he do that for?
Exactly. Let us move on to what we've already thematically addressed in terms of the Jon Favreau Lion King. We've had lots of discussion over this over the last couple of weeks, so Fergus has got very strong views about this. So indeed have various colleagues, etc. I've seen it. I've got to say I preferred the animation. But Richard, you first saw the trailer for this with Ben Lewis when he actually whipped out his mobile phone and actually sort of said, look, Richard, look at this screen. It's The Lion King, directed by Jon Favreau, about a year ago.
I have to say, firstly, I have to give this admission, I didn't see the 1994...
That's because you don't see animations.
No, well, I mean, I occasionally have to when it comes to the Oscars and so forth, but no, it didn't appeal to me. I haven't seen Bambi or Snow White. Course, explains a lot. I mean, listeners will be shaking their heads. But, I mean, for me, the live-action films have come at just the right time. They've introduced me to them. Jungle Book, Beauty and the Beast, Cinderella, and so forth. Dumbo, less happily, but nonetheless, the Jon Favreau did the Jungle Book. Here he's delivered something that's absolutely gorgeous to look at. I know the complaint. I will address the complaint. I agree with some of the complaint, but one of the things this movie is certainly fun. You've got a gorgeous, albeit Disney-fied Africa. You've got the richness of the animal life, the fauna, the flora, the mountains and the valleys, and you've got those wildebeest stampedes. And good filming, by the way. I rather like the way the camera, sometimes the camera saw what the animal was seeing. So it was moving through the, the bushes or the trees and so forth, following... what was going to happen? Would there be an elephant graveyard at the end of it? Would there, in fact, be vultures about to... I'm most amusing here. This was a movie. Jon Favreau, obviously, is a great admirer, as I am, of Lawrence of Arabia. I've seen it three times again in the last month, I would add. It's not the Prince Charles in Leicester Square next Monday for the final showing. And When the Warthog, a very, very entertaining little performance, I have to say. When the Warthog appears and quite literally looks like Omar Sharif coming out of that mirage in that famous scene in Lawrence of Arabia. You've got Seth Rogen's voice and you've got a quirky beast. I was very, very amused and roared with laughter. After all, vultures are circling around poor little Simba. So something has to happen. And there is Omar Sharif.
Yes. Okay. Fergus.
And you were not impressed with it because that yes spoke.
Steady, let's not go there.
No, but I mean, that was giving a clue. I must just also add, I thought Chiwetel Ejiofor stole the show as Scar, because Scar's one of the beasts that's able to show us a pretty large amount of nasty, menacing, mangy, predatory creature. I mean, this is a monster, if ever there was one, and Scar was able to show a great deal more character. There's been a lot of criticism of this movie because although you have James Earl Jones as the noble Mufasa, and also you've got Donald Glover of Simba, well, you've also got, for example, Beyonce, rather wasted when you have a lioness who seems to lack emotion. I mean, this is a problem with this movie because you have so many of the animals where they don't or aren't able to show, as it were, in their face what they feel. There's not that much emotion. So you can have lively meerkats and you can have quite a lot of amusing fun and games and you can have wonders with the scenery, but there is, I must confess, Not that it's spoilt my enjoyment of it. It didn't. I do think it's an exciting film, and I think also that within the beauty of the landscape there is a sense of danger, and I think that came across, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. But the criticism, which has spoilt it for quite a lot of people, is that they felt that the characters are very inanimate.
I'm looking forward to the animated version of Lawrence of Arabia.
I mean, now you better not get into that. That's a very dangerous thing.
I think so. I think it's begging out to be made for a cartoon animated routine. Fergus, your views on The Lion King, the remake.
Right. Well, I think maybe the benefit of not having seen the original maybe... maybe paints this film in a better light.
Okay.
The first film... The original is so kind of beloved. It made almost $1 billion at the box office in 1994. One of the highest grossing animated films of all time for years. I think it's probably best not having seen the original if you want to enjoy this film. Because a lot of criticism, and I kind of agree with them, it seems like a shot-for-shot remake of the original film, and I like the photorealism. It looks absolutely gorgeous. When you see the Circle of Life scene, it looks amazing, and just see how these real looking animals fit into the kind of landscape. I think it looks better than it did in the Jungle Book, probably because it had more time with it, but it's just got that same sort of energy that you have in the animated film. But with some of the song sequences, there's more life you get out of the hand-drawn animation. Chiwetel Ejiofor did well, but he's no Jeremy Irons when he delivered this great Shakespearean-like performance, like he was performing in Hamlet, be a reference there. Yeah, exactly.
Oh, goodness me, you're putting the bar pretty high.
But it's just, I think they tried to do things differently. Mm. The performances of Timon and Pumbaa in this, it's Seth Rogen and that, people enjoyed it in the screening I was in. I thought there were some funny moments in there, a few Disney inside jokes in there, like as a reference to Beauty and the Beast at one point. To separate from the original, I've said this to Alex and I've said this to other people, I would have taken the songs out.
Take the songs out.
If you've had a musical version of something, try and test
the strength. I quite enjoyed the songs, but there it rested. I didn't think they were anything special.
Well, if you see the original version, there's so much more life put into the songs.
And they've put another new song in by Elton John. It's astounding. I have sent you, Richard, whilst Fergus has been doing a link there, a wonderful YouTube critique by Grace Randolph, who is a American film reviewer who got all over the place. But actually, I do appreciate what she's actually said about this particular one. Emma, have you seen The Lion King? Do you intend to? That's the remake, or indeed the original.
I've seen the original. Mm-hmm. I absolutely love it.
Yeah.
I haven't seen the remake, but it is on my list of things to do. Okay.
Oh, I think you should see it. I mean, the point is, I mean, of course, there's been lots of debate on how they've reconstructed, you know, what technology is used and all of this, the songs and the fact they were a little bit flat at times. Yes, I did see. But one of the things that I did find fun was that you had, you know, the vastness of Africa, the plains, the beauty, the whole...
Animated system. It wasn't real, Richard. I mean, it was animated in itself. It was all CGI.
Well, yes, of course it was. And, I mean, the wildebeest stampede and where the camera was... poor little Simba hugging onto that tree and Mufasa trying to rescue... I mean, look, one of the things I did think... we haven't mentioned the hyenas, by the way. I do feel they should get a mention.
Yeah, no, they're the Brexit party.
I was very amused the fact that climactically, no spoilers, of course, but there is somewhat of a skirmish, we'll say that, and the numbers of hyenas who turn up are far more than those we actually... only see. This very often happens in movies. But, I mean, they were very entertaining as monsters. And, of course, you've got Scar. You've got the villains looking really villainous and absolutely horrible. With all the animals trekking for the pilgrimage to Mufasa at the beginning, and the fact, the actual thought that, I mean, it's ridiculous.
Richard, if
that
you want
Scar
to
could have taken over the lion.
Yeah, no more ridiculous than our current state of politics. It's almost as though the Lion King could have been written for our current system, and you can substitute the various characters as you see fit. But if you want a really emotionally overwhelming movie lasting 60 seconds, I would, Richard, and I'll send you another link to this, I would actually certainly say the latest Meerkat epic, which has actually been coming through, it is quite frankly awesome.
Oh,
isn't it, Emma?
Yeah,
is it not?
I mean, it I have seen that.
Just looking at that, with that, you start off with mass destruction in Africa, and all the sort of where they go off to. No spoilers,
so
obviously.
Correct at the moment.
And what is this Meerkat epic, the next advertisement, is it?
It is.
You may say next best advertisement. I would say a 60 seconds of sheer wonderment.
It's a lovely.
It's an epic.
Know, yeah,
it's epic.
It well, please send it, because at a time like this, we need cheering up, I think.
It might make you shed a tear. I certainly shed a tear.
Yeah, but it's a happy ending.
Thank you, Lord.
How many tears did. I mean, Alex, you haven't told us actually what you thought of The Lion King. You've sat on the fence very cleverly and got other people's views.
I tend to feel that of all of the recent remakes that Disney have made of its own product in terms of self-plagiarism or various other things...
A good idea, by the way, because enabled me to see it, enabled me to enjoy
I know, I appreciate that. I would say this, for me, is the weakest. I think it's okay, but I'd give it a 7.5 out of 10, probably.
Yeah.
But anyway...
What would you give Dumbo?
9, because I actually thought what Tim...
Burton?
He was doing something different. He was actually taking the narrative and actually moving it on.
Yeah, because I don't even remember that even coming out. It passed by me.
I do agree with that.
Anyway.
Yes, I have to say that, I mean, when it came to... I would have preferred... all the others, because quite frankly, it fell terribly flat. And I think if you give Dumbo 9, that speaks volumes. Oh, dear, oh, dear. And some of the ham acting in that. Gracious me.
Don't be elephantist, Richard. Don't be
elephantist. You set him off now.
But I mean, the reason, one of the problems with Dumbo with me was that I am not someone who tends to... like what Tim Burton produces, quite honestly, truly, madly, deeply. But I do have to make the point, I haven't looked at the Dumbo rating on Rotten Tomatoes, but I think it probably is pretty low.
Okay. We've got a few moments, literally just a few moments, for Only
You.
Oh, no,
we must. This is a lovely film, Only You, and it's got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes, set in Glasgow, and, I mean, rare to rave about a film that's just a love story, pure and simple, but, I mean, the rich layers in human relationships are so sensitively and perceptively explored in this. I mean, I absolutely loved it. It's a love affair between a 35-year-old teacher, Elena, played by Lia Costa, and a 26-year-old student, Glynn, played by Josh O'Connor, who you may well remember in a very, very sensitive film, it was the LGBT film, Help Me Out, it was the...
I would normally help you, Richard,
country.
But for a moment I'm lost on this one, basically.
No, very, very good. They share a cab, they end up sharing her flat, bequeathed by her father, and we learn little about her past, but this is such a passionate affair, and it really, really... there are very few films that absolutely intrigue me and draw me in the way this one did, but some graphic sex scenes, they are deeply in love, the movie shows it, and first-class performances from both principals, but when they try for a baby, what pressure does this put on and what result does this have on their relationship? And they turn from being mutually supportive to being mutually antagonistic. How do they sort this out? Or is it sorted out? What happens when she tries IVF? And what also happens when things change and what is their future together. Wonderful performances, totally recommended. I absolutely loved it, and the way the movie is filmed, the way we go through the details of their relationship, the way they want a child, their friends, the pressures on them, the fact that you've got a rather inexperienced guy with a bit of a bad temper who tries to be supportive, and you've also got someone who's intense, affectionate, moody, but also a bit insecure. This is Elena. There's absolutely no doubt that this is a glorious movie. I really loved it. Visually unobtrusive, but extremely good. Set in Glasgow, as Tell It to the Bees was. So that's two films set in Scotland, reviewed the last couple of weeks. Musical score enriched it. So, I mean, this just really didn't reduce the male and female characters to ciphers either, something that's very tedious in a lot of films, following an agenda that may well be politically correct and also has a lot of merit in it. But to see, there are too many movies that are formulaic at the moment. This isn't. It's a movie that is involving, it's truthful, it rang, certainly rang true to me, and I was very, very involved in this relationship. Masterly and riveting, Only You. And it is directed by Harry Woodcliffe, of whom I've never heard, but hope to hear a great deal in the future.
Of course, not to be confused with the Robert Downey Jr. Only You from 1994, which for a long, was one of the reasons why I was bemused, because obviously slip between trying to actually send Richard a copy of the Meerkat epic and indeed sort out Only You. Is it any surprise that we've sort of lost on that basis? But never mind, he delivered
I
as ever.
I would point out, incidentally, what we haven't said is that The Lion King has, again, all these movies are, of course, doing very well, or most of them are, but it's made an absolute fortune. It's just, it topped half a $1 billion just a few days after it was released.
Yeah, which basically shows that why cinemas actually have specific chains when they could just actually all rename all theatres Disney theatres, because that's the sort of Disney cinema we've actually got. So it goes. Emma, will you be checking out Only You?
Yeah, I think it sounds like my sort of film, actually. It sounds really lovely.
It is absolutely lovely.
Tenderly entwined performances. And Fergus?
I may check it out when it goes on demand, or maybe when it goes on TV.
Maybe when Disney actually make an animated version of
it. Oh, that's unkind.
Yeah, hang on. That's
terrible.
I may check it out when it goes on TV, because it's one of those films I like to check out when they show it, like, on Film 4 or something like that. Or if they put it on iPlayer. Watching a lot of iPlayer films at the moment.
Exactly.
Oh, it was God's Own Country, by the way. I did just about get it right.
I knew we would, Richard. That's why I gave you those extra few moments to let the whole thing percolate. I knew it was going to work through that.
It was a really, really powerful LGBT movie, and I think everyone gave that 5 stars.
Okay.
I hope folks agree.
Fergus, would you agree?
God's Own Country.
God's Own Country?
Yeah.
There we are, you see. Yeah, he would agree. So there we are. Fergus, it's time for you to put those last two interrogatives to our major fan of the current Prime Minister. Not. No, he's back. As I said yesterday, we're not going to have a sort of... Because you can only go so far before you realise you've actually gone into, as we decided yesterday, a parallel universe. Off you go.
Okay, Richard. Have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
More than reasonably interesting. I mean, Alex doesn't normally start off with political quotations in that way. Mm. And I mean, yes.
Just shows how I've been moved by the current state of affairs with our country,
I mean,
Richard.
You may be moved, but there is one thing for all the rhetoric in the world, and no one can deny. I mean, when it comes to Boris, I've heard him give a charitable speech.
It's nice to know
he amused the audience. He supported the Royal Society of Portrait Painters when his portrait was on show. But I've not seen that much of him. But when it's one thing to have charisma, when there is parliamentary arithmetic, that is, I mean, it's a totally different world.
Richard, just let it go. That's what we're going to have to do. We're going to have to let it go.
You can't, and I can't.
And the other question, whilst Joseph Williams is in with the tune in the back with the meerkat and indeed the warthog.
The hay. What about the hay?
Oh, that's you talking about that?
Yeah. I mean, I thought you were going to draw a parallel. You haven't, but the one thing I'm surprised is that the hyenas haven't, as it were, emerged, and you haven't drawn parallels between certain political
issues. Actually, no, Richard, if you listen again to this little link on podcast, you'll find I did drop it in there. So I shall say no more. Just he was there. Fergus, final question.
Will you be joining us again?
Oh, I certainly will be.
Aroma like a certain appeal. He could clear the savannah after every meal.
I'm a sensitive soul, though I seem thick-skinned. And it hurt that my friends never stood downwind. And oh, the shame!
He was a shame!
What a change in my name!
Oh, what's in a name?
And I got downhearted.
Can't it you feel?
Every time that I...
Hey, Pumba, not in front of the kids.
Oh, sorry. Hakuna Matata, what a wonderful phrase. Hakuna Matata, ain't no passing craze.
It means no worries for the rest of your days.
Yes, sing it, kid.
It's our problem-free philosophy. Hakuna Matata.
C-H-L-O-E and Y spells Chloe. S-A-C-V means sound and Chloe's vision each month on Siren Radio, where music, theatre and magic are made.
Actually, we need you to do a version of Hakuna Matata, Chloe. Have you ever thought about doing cover version? Yeah.
Well, this is definitely possible. Maybe you should try it.
So, I gather from our Gibraltarian correspondent, Gabriella, that actually it's hotter in Lincoln, England now than it is in Gibraltar in the Mediterranean. We have highs of 35 degrees centigrade, a low of 19 degrees centigrade. So, how's it shaping up in your part of Spain, Chloe?
Oh, it's lovely and warm. I think, I don't know if we are a little bit more warmer than back in the UK, but, you know, it's not a competition. It's still amazing.
Very true.
I could be wrong.
And I trust you're wearing sun cream and sunscreen?
Oh, absolutely,
yeah.
Yes.
Good.
Yes.
Good.
Must be safe, got Dang. To look after your skin. I have no tan, though. It is ridiculous. I've been here for over 2 months, and I'm not proud.
Well, that's presumably because you sing inside, you sing outdoors, you don't sort of go
that
out and about
in the
streets. So that's the important thing. And how are the audiences treating you?
Lovely, absolutely lovely. I mean, it's lovely because you get a different range of people as well. So it's always good. It's always Excellent. Good to meet new people and guests. Yeah.
Well, yesterday technically it was a birthday show for Ava MacDonald. We wished her happy birthday, but she wasn't actually in the studio with us because, as you know, Ava MacDonald is actually up in Withernsea, entertaining
Ooh.
People. I know. And also a news which I'm sure you're already well aware of, but I did decide I'd share it with you, Chloe, that Mrs. Galaxy Lincolnshire, or is it Mrs. Lincolnshire Galaxy?
Yes.
Anyway, she has become Mrs. Galaxy Island.
This is amazing. Oh my gosh, she's doing so well at the moment, isn't she?
And Jasmine Foley is actually off to Orlando in August to actually sort of go for the international line. Amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. Success after success. Well, and now she's got the Chloe Rose seal of approval. What more can you honestly say from that body?
Yay!
So we have Emma and we have Fergus in the studio, all set and ready to actually go in all sorts of ways and chat with you about your time in Spain. Is it halfway through now? Or are you there until November? I mean, what sorts of life?
I'm halfway through now. Until the end of October.
End of October. Mm, okay.
Yeah.
And how are the audiences treating you? I mean, are they appreciative?
Well, you get some people that really enjoy it, and you know, it's difficult because it's a matter of opinion, I guess. Some people are like really amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Some people. I don't know.
They just have no appreciation of talent. That's the key thing. It's just the way that they go there. So, Chloe, what's the typical set that you're actually doing? Because, I mean, we'll feature in a few moments Golden Dreams. But in terms of when Chloe Rose says, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, I'd like you to welcome to the wonderful sort of world of Spain. It's Chloe Rose. I'll give you a sort of nasally accent there because I think most MCs when they're actually in holiday camp. I mean, it's not a holiday camp. What are you actually doing over there?
Okay, so like I perform at hotels over in Mallorca, and it's like the set's very different to what I'd usually do, you know, because obviously I do quite a lot of my own music and songwriting, but for this sort of set, I can't do so much of that.
No.
So it's more like a range of different music. So it could be, it's like pop, rock, R&B.
So what's a typical set, Chloe? What does it actually comprise?
It could be anything from things I like Amy Winehouse,
mm-hmm.
Adele, but then it could also be, it could even have Elvis in there.
Really?
Yeah,
a female Elvis. Well, I suppose you've got a female Doctor Who.
as long as I sing it in my own way, you know.
Of course.
It still sounds okay. Good, you know. Mm. It's got to sound okay.
And which Elvis track do you actually go for, Chloe?
Oh, right. Well, there's a few. I quite like I Can't Help Falling in Love with You.
That's my favourite song.
Song is a good one.
I mean, I would say I Just Can't Help Believing as opposed to I Can't Help Falling in Love. But, you know, but what the heck? So why are you then, Emma? Is you know, like the river flows slowly to the sea, darling, so it goes?
I don't know. The lyrics are... I think the lyrics are really they're just lovely, you know, like the tune of it. I've always been quite a big Elvis fan,
right?
But yeah, I think that song is my favourite song.
Well, I think in a few moments time we'll be asking Zoe to actually give us some. Chloe, you should say a sort of general version down the line, because I mean in Spain it is 9:45 in the morning, so 9:45 approaching that, so it's gearing up. Nice to
have
vocal exercises and so on. Fergus, do you have a favourite Elvis Presley song?
Well, it has to be Suspicious Minds.
Oh, yes.
Like I love the ending where it always seems like it's fading out, then he keeps coming back, and then that goes about 5 minutes.
That reminds me of Lilo and Stitch.
Yeah, right.
I like Lilo and Stitch.
Oh, when he opens his mouth and he's running away. Yeah.
Chloe, how can people actually keep up with what you're doing in Spain on the socials?
Oh, well, just keep checking out my Instagram stories. So if you follow Chloe at Chloe Rose, Chloey Rose, I'm on Facebook, Twitter, and sometimes I'll put little stories, even of other people performing as well, you know, just to let people know what's going on and what's happening, and just, you know, get in contact with me.
Sharing the joy. That's the important thing, because, again, I think we saw through, because clearly, you know, the demand for when's we're going to get another full hour-long show of Sound and Chloe's Vision. Well, we can't because she's in Spain. But what we can do is we've officially designated you our Midweek Drive Morning Edition Spanish correspondent. So there we are. You see, that's the key thing. Yeah, add that to the whole system. Emma, would you like to hear Chloe singing Can't Help Falling in Love before we actually go into Elvis Presley's sort of piece?
Oh, in the morning.
Yeah. I know.
I would,
as a Tottenham fan, would you like to hear a Jurgen Klopp fan sing that whole sort of sequence?
You know,
I think we would.
Way.
Yeah.
I would.
Fergus.
If he wants to, I don't want to force him to do anything.
No pressure, Chloe. But I know you can actually do this. So, as we say, your official correspondent.
I don't know how I'd sound this morning.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'll give you a little sort of key to start you off with. Take it away, Chloe.
Wise men say, all this
genius. I think that deserves a round of applause for it's
yeah. I like hearing Elvis sing, though, in the background.
The thing is, Elvis is no longer with us, basically. He's left the building and he's working in a chip shop somewhere in Grimsby.
Ooh, that sounds great. I like big spicy fish and chips, I really do.
Do you not have a similar sort of thing in Spain? I mean, do they not? I mean, I thought surely they've got to keep the British people happy, or maybe not post-Brexit. You know.
Absolutely. I mean, the food's great. The food is fabulous, but, you know, I am missing... I've not had the fish and chips over here, but, you know, I tell you what, that Grimsby fish, I'm still proud of it now.
So you should be.
I really miss it. Yeah. I really miss it.
That's what I appreciate, you know, that it's there. It just works in every sense of conceptualisation. Yeah.
As well, roast dinner.
Do you know, if it's the end of October, there's something else that actually happens, I think, that people have been talking about that's also taking place at the end of October. We'd best not mention it, really.
Yeah, it's nothing.
No, it's Chloe. The most important thing is Chloe might be back in Britain then, so who knows. all right, Emma, go for it. Last two questions for Chloe Rose, please, before we go into Golden Dreams.
Ooh, so, Chloe, have you had a reasonably interesting telephonic link with us this morning?
I have. It's been lovely speaking to you all, and I hope you have a lovely day ahead as well.
Thank you. Will you be joining us again next week?
Oh, definitely. Great. If you'd like me.
Yes, of course.
Oh, come on. Chloe Rose, Golden Dreams. Yay!
Darkness I see. Chloe Rose and Golden Dreams. There's so much to pack into the programme, including the line, "I won't be Ashley's yes man." Yeah, Ian Lennox has actually been quoted. Oh no, it's Steve Bruce, who won't be Ashley's yes man. But what a wonderful time to actually be a Toon supporter, Ian, when you're signing a £40 million to people like Joe Linton. And, you know, I mean, you must be very excited. Even, you know, the likes of John Joe Shelby has said they can understand Steve Bruce. You know, it's like a whole fresh new world that's actually there. Honestly, you must be looking to the upcoming battle against Arsenal with great aplomb and excitement, yes?
No. after the debacle of Newcastle's behaviour during the closed season, both my daughter and I decided we weren't going to go anymore until after that. So, we're off to see people like Blythe Spartans and Gateshead and other teams, hopefully.
God, you'll be saying you'll be watching Tottenham next. Oh, sorry, Emma.
Hey. Exactly. That wouldn't be a bad thing to do, either.
Who knows? This could be the turning point in Mike Ashley's fortunes, that Ian and his daughter decide not to...
Well, he's already got my anonymous letter, so...
And you know who sent it to you as well. So no comment on the recent signing of Joe Linton, who many people have actually said, well, you know, who?
But, oh, he's a good player. Joe Linton's a good player. I've seen quite a few clips of him. He's
club record £40 million.
He doesn't play with his back to goal, as far as I can see, but he's very nimble, quick, very big and strong. And he seems to find space for himself with the ball at his feet and just crash through.
And a club record, £40 million.
Newcastle breaking their transfer record.
Take that, Michael Owen.
Who would have thought?
Exactly. Take that, Michael Owen. Yeah.
Well, I was always going to
give you Manchester City's drinks bill, isn't it?
Oh, shit. I think you need to just refrain from those kind of little lines here. You know, it's the difference. Little facts.
You do, and most people don't, though.
Steve Bruce, of course, it's his 11th club, spanning the top three tiers of English football. He's managed three sets of Derby rivals, Sheffield United and Sheffield Wednesday, Birmingham City and Aston Villa, and, of course, Sunderland and Newcastle. Wednesday, of course, are taking legal action against the legal advice, I'd say, taking legal advice. A joint statement attributed, apparently, to several Newcastle supporters groups described the appointment as unambitious. In terms of the actual sort of figures, he's average, really, which is great.
He was good back in the day, because I think he
for Manchester United.
Well, no, but he did work. Like, he got Birmingham City into the Premier League and kept them there for years. Mm-hmm. He made Wigan into a reputable club. Mm-hmm. He did work with Sunderland for years. Mm-hmm. You know, beach ball and everything. Mm-hmm. But then it just all went downhill after, I don't know, Sunderland got rid of it.
Exactly. Because secretly he was always designed to be heading for the Toon. Emma, any thoughts or any advice you'd like to give Ian about his club, or indeed Blythe Spartans?
I don't think I have any advice on that. But, you know.
Have you heard of Blythe Spartans?
They normally do very well in the early rounds of the FA Cup, I've found.
Right. Yeah. So there's a friend of mine actually owns them, so I thought I'd go and see it.
Oh, yeah. The Mike Ashley of Blythe Spartans. Does he put money into the team? We won't go any further. If he'd like to come on the programme, obviously the invitation is always there. Ian, do you know, because Richard Fitzwilliam just went on and on and on this morning about politics and so on, I just thought, is he ever going to stop? So it's a slightly shorter piece than normal, because after the news we've actually got to Colette Wade, who's the Vice President of Marketing and Business Development in Cornerstone, and a little survey that suggested that these days people are actually taking holidays in the summer, executives, and they're leaving their work to the youngsters, like Fergus and Emma.
Really?
And so those youngsters are having all sorts of challenging sort of moments because it's just too much stress. So, yeah.
I have got to ask, though. It's Spurs versus Man United today. Who are you rooting for to win for that?
That would be Ian, presumably you're asking for that.
I am asking Ian.
Because obviously I would say Spurs, because it's against Manchester United. I mean, no brainer.
Obviously,
no-brainer.
I would be quite insulted if you picked Man United over Spurs.
Exactly. So, but you know, Ian could go all over the place. You know, he's like a wild meerkat sometimes when he's let loose.
He's telling me a lift on the A19.
Yeah. So who would you go for, Man United or Spurs, Ian?
Are they playing today?
Yeah, 12:30 today. It's part of the
some sort of trophy.
I think there's three teams have broken away from the others. That's Man City, Liverpool, and Spurs. Spurs are third, I would guess. And I think Man United is still a work in progress, aren't they? He's having to rebuild his team. He hasn't got his centre half. I don't think he's going to get Longstaff from us.
And we did do very well the other day as well. So.
Yeah, but it's pre-season, so it's not that important, is it?
Well, I mean,
Man City lost, didn't they?
Against Wolves on penalties.
On penalties.
In China, exactly.
Exactly.
Yes. Yeah, they don't need all that much. some of these teams, I've got a whole stack of kids in them.
Yeah.
And they're probably having panic attacks due to the absent colleague workloads that they've actually had. People sort of turning up later and all sorts of things. I think he probably said he thinks Tottenham will actually win, although I don't think he said he wants Tottenham to win. So
I'll take it. I'm not going to push it. Yeah, I'm not going to push for any more. That's fine.
Then, Emma, you may ask Ian the last two questions before we head up to the news with Ant McAndrew and Muffin Song.
Oh, okay. Have you had a quick but reasonably interesting telephonic link with us today?
Yes, I have.
And will you be joining us again next week?
I hope so. I've got 30 seconds spare.
Of course. Yeah. And I'll try and remember your landline then as well. Whoa. Yeah.
I've almost been cut off.
And the weather today, highs of 35 degrees centigrade, lows of 19 degrees centigrade. It's going to be a sunny day with a moderate breeze. So we spoke about this in the first part of the programme, of course, that the end of summer is a busy time with holidays and all the rest of it. So 1 in 5 British folk plan to take off for holidays in the first, week of August the 5th. It's still there. Peak of the holiday season is approaching. So what's going to happen to all the businesses that are actually going to be left behind? Well, it could raise stress levels phenomenally with respect to colleagues who are being asked to help and so on. And who better to talk about this strange and bizarre sort of activity than the VP of Marketing and Business Development at Cornerstone On Demand, the wonderful Colette Wade. Good morning, Colette.
Good morning.
Okay, Colette, so you clearly have not taken time out. You're in the studio, you're doing your business from this point of view, and you haven't passed this task over to a junior to say, take it over, it's okay, don't worry, we'll cover the costs of stress and panic attacks and so on. But on a serious note, this is actually something which, is it symptomatic of the challenges that we get when the senior managers effectively leave and they say, oh, okay, let the youngsters take over, and it's maybe asking a bit too much?
Well, from the Cornerstone On Demand research that we've done recently, 67% of people's workload has increased in the last month alone because of absent colleagues. So we can only look to that increasing over the next month of August. And, where some of employees are left behind, your colleagues are left behind, and perhaps your boss has gone away, it's often an opportunity for you to step into their role and to be able to learn or hone new skills, hone your skills around people management, and actually see it as an opportunity. Despite the increase in workload, there are obviously lots of tips that the Cornerstone research came out with, which is ways that people can manage their time more effectively.
And actually, you've really put a nice positive spin on the whole aspect there, because, yes, one person's additional stress can be another person's opportunity. So is this a way in which, yeah, actually people can start discovering how things actually work and really sort of thrive by the added responsibility?
Absolutely. And our study, the Cornerstone study, showed that two-fifths, 40% of us, learn more advanced skills and gain a better idea of what that role involves. So, you know, I'd encourage anybody who reports into a senior manager to have a great handover from them and to take that as an opportunity and also as a sign of trust and empowerment by their manager that they believe that they can get on with the work whilst they're away. And when they come back, you know, it's a chance for them, that team member to shine, to say, this is what I've done, and also position themselves in a very positive light for future career prospects.
Okay, well, I think I'll just leave the show over to Emma and Fergus now, and I'll start my holiday at this particular moment in time. Emma, you've been reading the actual feature there. It talked about panic attacks suffered by young people because of additional pressure. Any thoughts or questions that you'd like to put to Colette?
I thought it was quite interesting that there was that positive spin on it, because I didn't really think about that, but it means that, do you think that it's not necessarily... I'm trying to find how to word it, not necessarily trying to get rid of handing over responsibility to others, but more in a case of how you handle it and making sure that they have the support there and guidance and everything while colleagues are absent. So it's not about, you know, changing it, it's just more about offering a bit more support.
Absolutely. I mean, the key thing in any business situation with team members left behind is to ensure that, if there is not already a formal work handover process, is create one. So be very proactive. Talk about the activities with your boss or other managers in the team. And also, whilst you're away, encourage them to come forward to other managers left in the business to ask for additional resources or perhaps delegate some of the activities to other colleagues who hopefully are not too overwhelmed as well, and even potentially extend deadlines, depends on the business, of course.
Are there any particular patterns in terms of whether we're dealing with the public sector or the private sector, whether we're dealing with small businesses, large businesses, multinational businesses, or is it pretty much a kind of similar pattern that we're seeing throughout?
Yes, from the Cornerstone research we did, it was not apparent that there was any great difference. In fact, the only difference that really stood out for myself was where there was a north and south divide on how employees felt when they were handing over work. And in fact, more in the north felt less guilty than those in the south about handing over work.
So because we have confidence in our youth, you see. We have confidence in our youth in the north, you see. In the south,
yeah.
Obviously, there's just not that shared confidence on that basis.
Absolutely.
Teasing slightly there, perhaps. Fergus, thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, I think, well, with it being the summer months, I think it's to be expected that a lot of people will see, well, after kind of a year of work, it's kind of there. Often you just take a couple of weeks off. What would be kind of your kind of key advice to these kind of younger workers that may not be long into the job, but they've had this increased workload as a result?
And would it be the classic Douglas Adams, don't panic, Colette?
Yes, don't panic. Keep calm. Number one top tip would be definitely to go and talk to a manager or whoever's in place to replace the person that's gone away. If not, maybe talk to your colleague about the workload. Highlight some of the areas where you're feeling the stress, what's becoming overwhelming for you. For example, are you working through your lunch hour? Are you working until 11 p.m. at night on emails? Those are both strong signals that all is not well. And, you know, managers need to be realistic as well at how they plan this overload of work during this period and be realistic what can be achieved. So it's keeping communication open. It's checking in with employees left in the workplace. You know, is everything okay? Anything I can help you with in terms of prioritization? And we've got lots of top tips, actually, on our blog, Cornerstone blog site at csod.co.uk/blog, where you can read more about the top tips for those handling more workload than usual.
Makes perfect sense. A reminder, the web address, would you like to just share it with us one more time, Colette, for people who either want to play the podcast back or indeed just want to get that pencil to actually write it down once again?
Sure. It's csod.co.uk/blog/performance, and you'll find the tips there.
Colette Wade, VP Marketing and Business Development at Cornerstone On Demand. It's been awesome. Take care. Don't work too hard. And hopefully we'll speak again very soon.
Thank you. Have a good day.
Taking off for summer holidays and so on, with the big summer getaway beginning to start. Apparently record numbers will be taking to the skies, with over 8,000 flights per day predicted. Now, clearly this might be all well and good in certain instances, but there are challenges, and some of those challenges have been identified by the wonderful NATS organisation, the global leader in air traffic control and airport performance. And indeed, from NATS, we're delighted to actually welcome NATS Head of Service Performance, and that'll be Wendy Howard-Allen. Good morning, Wendy. How are you?
Good morning. I'm fine, thank you.
Wonderful. So, I mean, again, whatever your views on the benefits or otherwise of air travel, etc., it does seem as though the airspace that we actually have in Britain is becoming increasingly crowded. And let's not go back to last year when we had the various mischief drone makers occurring. But, you know, quite apart from that, we've got problems with respect to the infrastructure of, indeed, our airspace around Britain.
Yeah, so we're expecting it to be very, very busy today. It has been throughout June and July, and air traffic is increasing every year, and it has been for the last few years. So it is getting more complex. We have airspace that is getting more constrained, and that's one of the reasons that, you know, we need to modernise our airspace so that we can cope with more capacity and keep the UK moving, reducing delays and redesigning the route network so that we can optimise the more up-to-date aircraft performance than when it was designed back in the 1950s.
So in essence, Wendy, really the whole system doesn't appear to be fit for purpose in the 21st century in many ways. Is that kind of the gist of the argument?
It is. I mean, we cope with it really well. We do an awful lot of planning for the summer. So we looked at, you know, last year's performance, and we do a lot of planning around the schedules, what we're expecting in different bits of airspace. And we move aircraft around so that we can try and balance the amount of aircraft in different bits of airspace. It obviously is congested around Europe. Europe has also put in quite a few measures this year, and they've moved some of their aircraft into other sectors of airspace around Europe to try and balance the delays across Europe.
Looking at some of the numbers that we see here, the UK's airspace handles around 2.6 million flights a year, carrying over 285 million passengers. There's an estimate by the government that that's going to rise by 2030, so 11 years from now, to 355 million passengers and 3.25 million flights. Now, we're aware the Green Paper on the Future of Aviation, Aviation 2050, has actually just been published from that point of view. But is that good enough? I mean, do we need to actually sort of start saying, OK, we always need a root and branch reform, really?
Well, that is what we're planning. So we're working with the government, the Civil Aviation Authority, and the UK aviation industry. So we're all working together to redesign the whole of the UK airspace, optimising routes. So we are planning for 2030 as well, and for the increase in both aircraft and passengers.
We're in the process of obviously celebrating the lights to the moon and so on, and there are those of us who kind of believe that by the time we'd be in the 21st century, we'd be having space tourism as a matter of course. Is the report kind of taking into account the likes of Richard Branson and so on who are actually looking for that, and will that also kind of have an impact insofar as obviously it's not so much flight-to-flight destinations, but it's going even higher into the stratosphere?
I'm pretty sure the report is taking that into account. It's not really my field, but I'm fairly sure that they are taking all aspects of aviation into account with the new modernisation of airspace.
And, of course, the reverse argument that we're often faced with, which is we're having far too much air transport travel. It's affecting the planet. It's causing climate change. You've got all sorts of problems. Is there a kind of contingency in terms of obviously we're looking for hopefully more greener aircraft and various other aspects working within the field?
Yeah, so part of this airspace modernisation programme is looking at making all journeys quicker, quieter and cleaner. So a big part of it is looking at our environmental performance with air traffic. We do look at that, obviously, today. So every aircraft is looked at from an environmental perspective as well. But certainly into the future, with new airspace design, we are definitely looking at optimising aircraft performance through the skies and making sure that it is environmentally friendly.
And presumably for people who wish to actually find out further information, just go to nats.aero, A-E-R-O. You won't get a chocolate bar, but you will actually get a wonderful report with respect to NATS and lines that we've been discussing today.
That's correct.
Wendy Howard-Allen, Head of Service Performance at NATS, many, many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you.
And we move from there to another extraordinarily interesting story in which doctors have been admitting that short appointments put patients at risk. One in three GPs have admitted that short timeframes stop them properly diagnosing patients. GPs are expected to keep to appointments less than 10 minutes, and a minimum safe time frame usually is regarded as being between 16 to 20 minutes, which clearly is not good news. So to talk a little bit about this particular phenomenon and hopefully address the challenges that are faced within that. We're delighted to welcome a lawyer for employment lawyer extraordinaire, Palm Sahota. Palm, are you indeed there?
I am indeed, yes.
Good to speak to you, the good self, Palm. Can you just talk us through, I mean, those were the headlines in terms of this particular survey, but you know, clearly if you are literally scheduled to focus on time and time is everything, etc., you say, sorry, your time's up, you've had your 300 seconds, it's time to move on, that can't be good for anybody, really.
No, because GPs are saying to us that they just don't have enough time to properly diagnose patients. And there is a risk that GPs fear that they've missed serious health issues due to short appointment times.
Now, I believe we've also got a case study online as well. Will you introduce yourself and talk us through sort of your own challenges with respect to this particular finding and survey?
Hello, hi, my name's Dr. Eleanor Holmes.
Hello, Eleanor, good to connect
with you.
Okay? Yes, indeed, it's all, the technology is working. Marketeers have done us proud, so great stuff there. So share with us, Eleanor, from your point of view, as a GP, is what we've just been talking about, or is it a case of, no, I can actually sort of work my way through 20 patients in the course of half an hour?
No, absolutely not. So I was have been a GP working in the North East for more than 10 years, and I took the difficult decision to leave clinical practice earlier this year because I just felt I couldn't do my job safely or deliver the quality of care that I knew I was capable of, related to workloads, unsustainable workloads and pressures created by funding cuts and staffing crises in the NHS.
Huge tasks and huge things that clearly need to be addressed. I mean, Palm, returning to yourself, you're listening to this, you've seen the survey from that point of view. I mean, is there light at the end of the tunnel? Is it a case of, well, with the current government, who knows where we're going to be going?
I think there is light at the end of the tunnel. What we really want to do is just shine a light on this problem and, you know, ask the people with the power to listen to the GPs and to work with them to see if a solution can be found.
According to the Nuffield Trust, the average doctor now has 125 more patients to look after than they did 5 years ago. I mean, Eleanor, you know, you go into the medical profession, best will in the world, to help, to assist, etc. But from what you've described to us, actually, you can't do your job properly if you're literally constantly faced with targets and quantifying targets and meeting targets and so on and league tables. You know, it becomes a kind of vicious circle of the worst kind, surely.
Absolutely. It isn't just the amount of time we're given, which 10 minutes is woefully inadequate given the complexity of problems that we're seeing now in general practice. Our caseloads have changed radically, and yet the system that we have to see patients in hasn't changed to reflect the times changing and medical advance and ageing populations. All of those things are problems. But yes, the solution lies in a political dialogue, yeah. An open, honest dialogue about how do we fund the NHS and make it safe, not only for patients, so patient safety is obviously very important, but I think we need to get away from talking about that in isolation. It's about safety, overall safety, which includes staff safety, because that impacts on patient safety. All of this, staff well-being and the way we work, the workloads being manageable, is the same as the second side of the same coin of patient safety. And we really need to get this message out there that this isn't working. This does not work. It is not safe. You have a perfect storm of problems, and people are leaving the profession in droves because they simply cannot deliver the care that they know they want to be able to deliver. And that we need to have a dialogue with the politicians about this, and we need action now. It is at crisis point, and we definitely need to think about funding solutions and discussing with government about how we do this and how we achieve these ends.
We've obviously just had a change in terms of premiership. We've had a change in the kind of line from there, and I'm sure that there'll be people who are listening to this who will say, oh, it's okay, we'll hand over to the United States. They'll look after the NHS because they want to buy into it. That's not going to work, is it, Eleanor? I wouldn't have thought. Or
No, it's very alarming. And I think what I find particularly problematic is that there's clearly an agenda for privatisation in the Conservative government, no more so now than now with this current leader. Mm. And we are not being honest about it. That, you know, Trump came over here and said that, yeah, of course the NHS was on the table for negotiation after Brexit. And then suddenly backtracked from that because it seems to be a vote loser.
And likewise,
we need open discussion about this so that the public can be informed and then vote accordingly if they want privatisation. But I certainly don't think that is the answer. I believe that the NHS in principle is an absolutely wonderful thing to maintain, free at the point of access and paid by progressive taxation. But the current model does not work, and we need to address that and have an open dialogue. I think there's a lot of studies that say that if the public would be willing to pay more money, if they knew, it definitely would go into frontline services in the NHS. And so we need to take, I believe, the NHS is a political football, and it needs not to be a political football. It needs to be taken out of the five-year cycle because you cannot do any workforce planning or funding planning or anything beyond this 5 years. It's very short-termist. It doesn't work.
Okay, let's briefly move into a couple of things. We've got two fine folk in the studio, both in their early 20s, so in a sense they're very much facing the future of the NHS, this fantastic organisation that indeed we've featured the nephew of Nye Bevan, who actually founded the whole thing in times past. Emma, you've been listening to Eleanor there, you've been listening to Palm. Are you concerned? Is it a case of, oh, what the hey, I'll just have to not fall ill at all and not see the GP?
I mean, you know, that's always the hope, that you don't fall ill. You know, it is very worrying. I was just wondering if you think there's any other factors with it, because I know for myself it's quite hard lately to try and get a doctor's appointment when you need them. They always seem to be fully booked with lots of people going to the doctors. You know, even if they do try to shorten down the time frame for patients. But do you think that sometimes people book appointments to go see a doctor when they don't necessarily need one? So do you think there's some other factors like that, that there's a bit maybe of a abuse of the system or something?
Is there still some slackage, Palm, that people can actually see? I mean, I suspect Alan would say, of course there isn't, that's why I've had to leave. But Palm, from your own point of view, has Emma got a point that maybe sometimes actually we've still got areas where people are not using the system from the patient point of view as much as the GP's point of view?
Well, I think GPs will try and identify, you know, who is an urgent appointment. And if it's relatively simple, I'm sure GPs will be able to get to the bottom of that problem and treat the patient safely and within the time they've got. It's when, you know, when patients come in and it's something maybe a little bit more complex and a little bit more detailed than just simple solution, where they need to spend that little bit extra time, they just don't have that.
And Fergus, any thoughts from yourself on what you've been listening to?
Yeah, it is the situation is just becoming worse and worse, really, with the amount of increased workload on GPs. It's a story we've been hearing for a while, but it doesn't seem to be getting any better.
It's fair to say when we're losing good doctors like Eleanor from that point of view, it's a challenge. Eleanor, is there light at the end of the tunnel? I mean, we talked about dialogue, we talked about the need to actually get coordinated with those people. Can go to slatergordon.co.uk to find out more information about this, or indeed nuffieldtrust.org.uk to find about this. Do you think there's a sense that we're there, or is it a case of here we are approaching the third decade of the 21st century and the health system, which has been fantastically celebrated over 50 years and 60 years, 70 years and more, is literally on its last legs?
I think there is light at the end of the tunnel if we can have the kind of political dialogue I was discussing before around funding. I mean, austerity and the austerity agenda has directly played into this. I need to be quite clear that although rising demand on the system, you can talk about changing expectations of what the NHS should offer. We live in a capitalist continuous
and do we also head to...
Now,
yeah. Do we head to the notion of basically where various devices like the Amazon Alexa effectively take over from the GP? It's not going to work suddenly if you're dealing with a more mature audience and they say, you know, tell me about what I feel. I mean, it's a possible stopgap, but it's not maybe the whole solution. Maybe you still need that human contact, perhaps.
Absolutely. I've just like to say, the solution to this does not lie in an app. Mm. I mean, although you feel sometimes from the government that their ultimate aim is to replace us with robots and apps, that is completely not what medicine is about. It's about human connection and building relationships. You ask anyone at the end of the day, would you rather tap some symptoms into an app and have a face-to-face human interaction? I think they're, especially when people are feeling vulnerable human being.
We'll close that, Eleanor, by just testing it. Eleanor, would you prefer a real-life human being or an app?
Real life human being.
And Fergus?
Real life human being.
That's unanimous then. It's been, we can go on and on about this, but time as ever is challenging from that point of view. Palm Sahota, lawyer from Slater and Gordon, and Dr. Eleanor, many thanks indeed. Keep up the good work, and hopefully we'll get some solutions going in the near future. Many thanks.
I hope so. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Just standing there, and I thought I was only dreaming, yeah. I kissed you then, at night give such delight. We all leave before morning light. Please don't go. No, please.
Well, we've just been talking to the National Air Traffic Services, so that's obviously one form of transport sorted. But when it comes to, obviously, again, another standard getaway, we often use our automobile friends and drive around in all sorts of other magical things. However, big problem again here, because drivers apparently spend little to no time preparing for major journeys. With, of course, many about to set off on staycations this summer, we could be heading for the greatest ever number of breakdowns on the M1, the M25, the M6. These are statistically shown to have high accounts, etc. So how are we going to address this? Well, we've got to bring in a super team, a top trio of fine folk. First of all, from the Institute of Advanced Motorists, or for Advanced Motorists, that's I Am Road Smart, Rebecca Ashton. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
And also from Swinton Insurance, who of course commissioned the research, etc., Gareth Tench. How are you, Gareth?
Good morning.
And from AXA, Sarah Bryan. How are you, Sarah?
Good, thank you.
Good. Sarah, if we can come to you first in terms of this particular research that we actually found from this point of view, were you surprised, or is it a case of, well, yeah, people don't check their cars, they don't actually check their oil and fluid levels, and so they break down, end of story?
I think I was surprised to see that, you know, we do worry as motorists about this happening, and yet we don't actually do a great deal to mitigate it. Mm-hmm. But certainly from a roadside assistance provider, we're not totally surprised, because, you know, it's common for it to happen. So we see a lot of this, and faults that happen to tyres, for example, that you'd expect people to look at but don't always think about it when they're packing their cars.
Sure. Rebecca, from the point of view of the Institute for Advanced Motorists, and clearly this sort of angle of prevention being better than cure is something you would adhere to and say, yeah, just get it sorted out.
Absolutely. Vehicle checks are hugely important, and you need to make sure that your car is ready and fit for you to get into to start your holidays. After all, hopefully you're going off to have a wonderful time. The last thing you need is a breakdown or something going wrong on the way.
Gareth, with more than a fifth of drivers worrying about breaking down and getting stranded, I can understand that. I mean, I have experienced that from that point of view.
You and me both.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it is one of those sort of things where you think... You know, sometimes obviously these things happen, but what are your thoughts on the whole system? I mean, is it a case of actually we take those checks, etc., but ultimately, you know, we need to be prepared?
Well, absolutely, yeah. What you should do, you can do a lot of checks, like check your tyres and your oil and water and your fuel, but the worst can always happen, so you should always check you've got cover in place, and more importantly, the correct cover level.
Mm.
From my experience, I'm a drive locally, so if I was a customer, I would check that I've got Nationwide for if I'm doing longer journeys. So I'd always check that if the worst does happen, that I'm covered.
Absolutely. Now, in terms of obviously working through that process and ensuring you've got that as backup there, if we return to Rebecca, three things that really people should actually do. Is it the old standard system of your tyres, your oil levels and your water levels? Are those the three things, or am I completely incorrect on that one?
Yeah, I would say those are three important things, but we've also got to think about our lights, making sure that they're all working, and of course your windscreen washer water, because if you're going down the motorway, there's chances are you're going to have a few bugs on your screen, so you want to try and keep it as clear as possible.
Do you find that there's a difference between the generations here? I mean, do you get, because obviously there is the notion that, oh, you know, some people have had the experience of working through that and they're sorted. Or is it a case of actually there's not a great deal of difference between more mature drivers and younger drivers?
Yes, the Swinton Insurance research definitely showed that there is a difference. And I think the reason is perhaps older drivers this has happened to before, and they're just wanting to make sure that they don't get caught in the same pitfalls that they were, whereas perhaps the younger people believing that maybe it won't happen to them.
Now, Gareth and myself have obviously admitted that we've had challenges on the road before, and we've sort of been open about that, and yeah. Sort of covered for that. I've got to ask the question, Rebecca and Sarah, have you also had challenges in your time on the roads?
I have broken down back in the day when I had an old car and I was young and I didn't think quite so much about the checks that I needed to do, but I learnt my lessons.
Yeah, and Sarah?
I actually haven't, and you know, considering I work in the business.
Polishing the halo there,
yeah,
obviously.
Yeah. I know. I think I've been very lucky, yeah.
Okay, where can folk actually go to find out further information? First of all, Rebecca, in terms of the Institute for Advanced Motorists and doing those checks and so on.
Okay, well, I would say go to our website, I Am Road Smart. But if you go to the Swinton Group website, you'll also see that there's a link there with all the advice.
And that covers that perfectly in terms of, obviously, Swinton Insurance. And as I think used to be the catchphrase, obviously, nobody looks harder to actually find a better quote than Swinton Insurance from that point of view. So shameless plug for that perspective.
Thank you very much.
Sarah, Rebecca and Gareth, many thanks indeed. Happy and safe driving.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
And from driving, we move straight away to another story which makes you think, oh, please, no. More than 1,800 dogs were actually stolen in the United Kingdom throughout 2018. And we're actually just coming to the end of the peak month for thefts. July was the peak month last year. 65% of pet owners believe that most thefts occur in the street or outside shops. And figures are actually showing that twice as many are stolen from inside homes. Now, the trauma and tragedy that obviously losing a pet can actually provide for a pet owner, canine or otherwise, is incalculable in many ways. So we're pleased to be able to feature now to talk about these findings from the Blue Cross Pet Bereavement Support Service, the wonderful Diane James. Good morning, Diane. How are you?
Good morning, and thank you very much for that introduction.
No, only true, basically. But these research, I mean, we heard recently, I think about a year or so ago, when I was looking at thefts in the country, etc. It's, I mean, I can't understand the mentality of why people would want to steal a pet in the first place, but it happens, it takes place, and we need to be aware of that, surely.
We do, and you know something, it is absolutely devastating to a family or anybody when they get a pet stolen. I don't think people realise the devastation and the effect it has on people. But it is happening more and more. And when we looked at the statistics and areas, in Lincolnshire, it's nearly three times more likely that your pet will be stolen from your home.
Yeah, I mean, that's outrageous in all sorts of ways. Staffordshire seems to be, or at least rather the breed, seems to be the most popular pet to actually steal. If you have a mongrel, is it okay? Or is it a case of, no, they go for targeted breeders, etc.? Because, clearly some of the findings that we actually have from this particular survey tend to suggest that, you know, there are certain common breeds of dogs. Staffordshire Terrier, of course, being the most commonly stolen breed of dog, with Jack Russell Terriers consistently being the second most common breeds stolen. Is that because of their size?
No, it can be any dog. I mean, we also find an increase in flat-faced dogs such as pugs, French bulldogs. And when you talk about any dog, the devastation of losing any dog, because sometimes people will just take any dog because the fact that it's there, irrespective of what breed it is, it's just targeted.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we have two fine folk in the studio, Fergus and Emma. Fergus, we'll come to you first. You've seen the story, you've seen the figures. Any thoughts? Or is it a case of, well, in Leicester, everybody's safe?
I have no idea why anyone would steal someone else's pet.
Mm. Would you be one of the 94% people who'd support a change to the law that would enable judges to actually hand down longer sentences to criminals? And they are criminals who actually steal pets.
Yeah, if it sorts out the problem, then it may have to resort to something like that, because it's just what would be recommended to prevent this from happening, really?
Oh, well. I mean, Diane, presumably apart from keeping your pet with you all of the time, which sometimes may not necessarily be ideal. Is it a case, I mean, are we looking at basically, does microchipping help, for instance? Because I mean, clearly it's a legal requirement that the pets are microchipped, or dogs certainly might be microchipped. Is that something which can assist within this? Is there a, do we need to improve the technology, Diane?
I mean, as long as the microchips are updated when people move, and also, you know, it is important that vets scan the microchips when animals come in. But what we do find is that if somebody is convicted of stealing a pet or a dog or a cat or any type of animal, they very rarely get a custodial sentence. Although they could be issued with one, it tends to just be the same sort of as if you've stolen somebody's mobile phone. So it's usually a finable offence.
Yeah, well, that doesn't seem to be right at all. I'm not necessarily looking for more draconian measures, but it just seems to be a bit unusual. Emma, your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I was very surprised to find out that there's more danger of dogs being stolen from the home, because I would have assumed, like most pet owners did, that it would be more likely when you tie them up outside a shop or any other point when you're outside of the house. So, you know, what can people be doing to make sure that their homes are safe and everything, especially in this weather, you've got windows and things like that open. Mm. And I know that my dog always used to bark whenever people used to walk across the street, so it's quite easy to determine which houses actually have pets in them.
It is. I mean, the best advice you can give as well is, because obviously in this weather there are windows open, so, you know, try and keep the animal in a different room. If they go out into the garden, which a lot of us do in this weather as well, make sure it's all secure. And sadly, keep an eye on them. The days are gone now where we could let our animals wander freely in our own property. We have to keep an eye on them at all times, which is very sad.
I suppose it's yet another part of the responsibility that pet owners need to be aware of. And as we frequently said, Diane, you know, pet is for life, not just for Christmas, from that point of view. Is there a website or sort of place that you'd recommend people should actually check out to find some tips in terms of making sure that they follow a checklist to make sure that they reduce the probability of their pets actually being stolen?
There is. We have lots of advice on our bluecross.org.uk/pet theft site. And sadly, if you have been a victim of pet theft or your pet's died, that's where our Blue Cross Pet Bereavement Service comes in. Totally free on 0800 096 6606.
Diane, it's been wonderful speaking with your good self. We must speak again, but hopefully on something which is a bit more positive than this particular feature, which I think we've hopefully raised a little bit of awareness about. But at the same time, again, it's best not to, mixing metaphors, shut the proverbial canine door after the canine has been stolen in all sorts of ways. You need to make sure that prevention is better than cure in every sense of the word. Diane James from the Blue Cross Pet Bereavement Support Service, many thanks indeed.
Thank you for having me.
Five months, 2 weeks, 2 days. My loving baby's been gone. 5 months, 2 weeks, 2 days. My loving baby's been gone. If you see my baby, please send her home for me. Hurry, oh home, baby. 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 Hurry, oh home, baby.
Fair to say, when she first pointed out the recent research that suggested that many British people actually admitted to bearing all whilst on holiday, we got a bit of a negative reaction from our listeners, and indeed our co-presenters, but still, what the hey? The key thing, of course, that's coming out of this research is actually protecting yourself when you're in the sun. And who better to actually talk about this particular research than, effectively in many ways, Love Island's finest and in general all-round wonderful soul and full of acres and acres of wonderful medical advice. It's Dr. Alex George. How are you, Alex?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Good. Now, this particular survey, as I say, suggests that actually, when we're doing our sunbathing, astonishingly, 62% have admitted they don't always use sun protection. Surely that's insane.
Well, Hotels.com did this research and basically found that there's no longer a taboo in ditching the swimwear and bearing all, and people are very happy now to even have a skinny dip. I think around a third they found of Brits are happy to get the kit off and have a dip in the ocean. So what we're saying is it's absolutely fine to enjoy and, you know, get your top off and enjoy and relax, but it's just being careful, protecting your skin, making sure that we do use skin protection and sun protection. So yeah, it's kind of scary sometimes to hear that 62% admit they don't always use it, particularly here in the UK. So yeah, just be careful, you know, enjoy yourselves, enjoy the sun, but cover up.
7%, of course, never wear sun cream at all. And red is not a good look, you know, that kind of fresh boiled lobster routine. It's not a healthy sign at all.
No, it's not the healthiest look. And I did have a bit of trouble with that myself.
I wasn't going to mention it, but last summer, yeah.
Did have a little bit of trouble with that myself. Moving forward and learning from that is just so important to look after your skin.
So, I mean, why is it then that bearing oil on the beach is increasing in popularity? Because I gather that actually in France, for instance, very, very few topless beaches now, more people covering up. I mean, is this just a case of, well, Britain's behind the times once again? By the time everybody else actually starts taking their clothes off, we'll be putting our clothes back on.
Maybe that is the case. I think as the country are becoming more liberal, we see some also, maybe it's to do with trends, like some of the TV stars Made in Chelsea have had a few, shots of them, you know, on the beach and not wearing very, very much at all. So maybe they're setting trends and things. I think we are just becoming a bit more liberal. We enjoy a skinny dip. I myself have jumped into the very icy cold Pyrenees rivers, maybe on a skinny dip once or twice myself. So we're all having fun, and that's fine. It's just about being careful at the same time.
I suppose from a medical point of view, you could actually take it to the Scandinavian sauna where you're actually beaten with birch leaves, etc. But whether that actually helps the treatment or is the cure, I'm not sure.
I'm not sure.
In terms of that forgetfulness, why is it then that so much people say you make sure you wear sunscreen, lots of sort of adverts about ensuring that you wear sunscreen. So why is it we forget? Is it just a case of, well, we're human beings?
What we're finding is that people are much better generally when they go abroad. It's almost like a checklist. All right, I'm going on holiday, I need the sun cream. We actually think about it much more. What we're finding is that people, particularly they're staying in the UK, don't always realise that, you know, the British sun actually has plenty of UVA and UVB that can cause damage if you're not careful. So it's particularly realising when we're here, you know, in our hot summer holidays, which we do have, you know, it's been a very warm last few weeks, we still need to use some sun cream.
And in terms of obviously the range of factors and things that you actually got for sunscreen, whether it's plus 30, plus 50, etc., what advice would you actually give to those going away or indeed having a staycation if the weather turns out nice, as it occasionally does in Britain, when it comes to protecting their skin?
So even if you're going to bear all, I would say using...
Not in the centre of Lincoln, though, please.
Yeah, not in the centre of Lincoln. You might get in a little bit of trouble for that. But using a SPF at least 30 and UVA, four-star rating and above, is really the minimum you should be using, particularly on those more sensitive parts.
Now, apart from obviously hotels.com, I'd also give a full plug to the @DrAlexGeorgeOfficial Facebook page, which, of course, leads you into the waiting room with Dr. Alex. It's like a whole brand, which is fantastic stuff from that point of view. Is there anything else, Alex, you'd like to suggest people should go to in terms of finding out information about what we've been talking about, or indeed seeking some advice to avoid that lobster red or indeed salmon pink approach that sometimes can impact people if they're not careful when it comes to the sun?
Yeah, absolutely. So hotels.com have more information on this campaign, a little bit of information as well about how to stay safe while having fun, particularly if you are going to be bearing all. So yeah, head to their website.
And clearly you've moved obviously from Love Island into baking and a whole range of other sort of actors.
Yes.
Any other sort of sneak previews of where Dr. Alex George will be emerging in the public consciousness in the near future?
Well, aside from doing MasterChef, I'm doing my second series of The Waiting Room right now, and have some very exciting guests on the show coming, including Vicky Patterson, talking about kind of body image and social media. So, yeah, please stay tuned and have a listen.
It will be awesome. Dr. Alex George, many, many thanks indeed. Take care now.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Okay, Emma, you're leaving us a little bit earlier than normal because you've had enough, basically. You're off to do something.
I'm going
check
on
out,
my holiday
yeah,
now.
Check out, wear sunscreen.
Yes,
you've just been
I
listening to
do.
That right
I have,
there.
Actually.
Well,
I've got it on my face.
Fantastic.
And I've got it on my arms.
Exactly. It's all very important. And we'll see you next week.
Yes.
Excellent. Fergus, thank you. It's been awesome as well. Yeah. Stick around for our sort of final farewell. Up next for the final interview of the programme, we have the champion-winning Great Britain Sail GP team comprising Chris Draper and Matt Guttrell, and maybe a special bonus as well. Honestly, we spoil you, dear listener. We spoil you. Well, there's one thing we can always pretty much guarantee with Great Britain being an island, that really when it comes to boating and sails, etc., we should actually be doing quite well. But when we actually get the notion that we're actually going to do even better with the launch of a brand new Great Britain Sail GP team at this year's Cowes Festival, then it gets even more exciting and wonderful. And to actually talk a little bit about this and share some of the excitement with your good self, we've got not one, not two, but three amazingly talented, wonderful boating folk. First of all, from the Great Britain Sail GP team, it's the fabulous Chris Draper. How are you, Chris?
Yeah, I'm very good. Thank you very much for having us here today.
Wonderful. We've also got, from the same team, of course, Matt Gottrell, MBE. How are you, Matt?
Yeah, very well, thank you. Good morning.
Very good. I was tempted to say Tottenham Hotspur supporter as well, but that's okay. We can sort of work our way through that. It's down the line. And we've also got the awesome Richard Mason. How are you, Richard?
Hello, the awesome Richard Mason.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
I think so. Matt, if we can come to you first to just talk to us about this really exciting thing, because it actually, you know, Lewis Hamilton, obviously, in Formula One, it's almost become a procession, but it sort of suggests, you know, we've got great stuff there. This is a real opportunity to make Cowes just come alive even more than it usually does.
Yeah, I mean, if anyone hasn't seen these boats there, they're pretty spectacular. So using the kind of tagline, the Formula One of sailing, it's pretty realistic, really. So yeah, for us to come down to Cowes and sail in these amazing boats in front of the home crowd is going to be pretty special. And yeah, like I said, the boats are kind of completely different to what sailing is kind of used to be like. So yeah, these boats go up to 60 miles an hour is the target. So yeah, pretty special to see those flying around the Solent.
The fastest sail racing boats in the world. I mean, Richard, from your own perspective, is this something which you thought, yeah, fine, bring it on, I want that now?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, doing sailing like this is something you aspire to in your whole career. You know, I've been looking up at, well, these boats have only existed for a very short amount of time. The technology is coming on so fast. We've only just been able to sort of race them in this sort of format. So it's a really new and exciting thing. And it's just something that I've dreamt of doing since I started sailing when I was an absolute nipper, you know, age of four. So it's fantastic to be doing it at home in front of British public. And yeah, I can't wait.
I'm always quite amused when I talk about doing Cowes Festival. It's one thing which I know has always been on our list of things to do. We've covered various other activities and so on, a London Boat Show and so on, but people say, oh, do you go in a field somewhere and actually look at the milk? No, it's Cowes Isle of Wight, just in case people are confused from that point. Very, very critical from that perspective. But continuing this theme about the way in which this whole championship is being developing, it's claiming to redefine the sport of sailing. So, I mean, again, from that point of view, any thoughts with respect to that, Chris?
Yeah, I mean, these boats are hydrofoiling, so they're not actually like plodding along in the water like a traditional sailboat. They're actually flying above the water, and we have a pilot that's actually flying the boat the whole time that we're sailing. They're flying that not with like a joystick like in a plane, but with a controller that allows them to change the angles of attack constantly while we fly the boat above the water, which is why we're able to sail at such high speeds. And then we also use a wing to power the boat rather than a traditional sail that goes up and down a mast. We've actually got like a plane wing that produces an enormous amount of horsepower, which is why we're able to sail the boat so fast. So, and the other thing with this racing is that it's not in traditional ways like where you're sort of 2 miles off the shore. You're literally, it's right in front of the shoreline. You know, if you had a really good arm on you, you could throw your drink from the spectator gallery into the boat and land it there while they're doing sort of 50, 60 miles an hour in front of you. So it's an incredible spectacle. And for us as racers, you know, it doesn't get any better than getting to race in a home, on a home turf in front of a home crowd in these kind of boats. It's just incredible.
I'm very tempted to say sailing's coming home, but that's too cliched, and we'll move to a different line entirely. But you're currently placed third. You've already travelled to Sydney, San Francisco and New York in the inaugural season of Sail GP. Chris, are we quietly optimistic and quietly confident that we're going to do the business, and just as our cricketing fellows actually did, we're going to do some magic here at Cowes?
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly the summer of sports certainly been setting a bit of a precedence. I mean, we'd love to carry that on, and obviously we're going to Cowes planning to do everything that we can to win that event. And the standard's very, very high, and we have a really young team, and Dylan, our skipper, is very new to these boats, but been showing a massive potential and an enormous ability. And in the second event in San Francisco, we had some incredible performances, and we're very, very close to winning that event. So we're learning really, really fast. We've got a lot of new sailors to these kind of boats, but the learnings curve has been absolutely vertical. So we're really, really hopeful going into that event, and I think having that home advantage and some home support and everything, and just capitalising on those gains, we really stand a good chance of doing it in front of our home crowd.
Which is good, so fingers crossed with respect to that. Now, 3 Olympic medals, 12 world championships between the three of you. I mean, it's fair to say, Richard, you're reasonably experienced when it comes to that. Again, same question we put to Chris, really. Are you kind of thinking, yeah, this is possible, but, you know, we take it step by step at a time, one wave at a time?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it sounds like a bit of a sports cliche, but you can't go into an event, you know, planning to come third. You always want to go in wanting to win. That's sort of what drives you forwards, but obviously we need to just focus on our process goals and make sure we do all the things right. If you make a little mistake in these boats, you get punished really, really hard. We unfortunately made a little mistake just before New York, and you know, that cost us in the racing, so we need to look to just do the best we can be for this Cowes event, and yeah, hopefully we can put on a good show.
Australia, China, France, Japan, and of course the United States of America make up the rest of the field from that point of view. Any of those crews impressed you guys in terms of thinking, yeah, you know, okay, they're a bit sort of useful when it comes to this? I mean, Matt, any thoughts from yourself?
Yeah, definitely. It's been quite clear to see from the season so far and the races we've had that the Australians and the Japanese are probably the two we've got to try and chase down. And we've had some close races and close battles with them over the year so far. So it'd just be nice for us to just get the edge on them in this one. But there's some talented sailors across the whole fleet, and anyone on their right day can go and win a race. So that's what makes this so racing so good, is that you only need to win one race to win the event. So yeah, you want to be in with a shout.
And we mentioned obviously the Tottenham Hotspur allegiances of Matt from Lloyd from that point of view. Chris, I gather that you also quite like kite surfing and snowboarding in your spare time. Is this true? I mean, did you ever get the sports confused from that point of view?
Yeah, I love anything with a board attached to my feet. My kids are the same, you know. But I think I just love being out in the water and things like kite surfing and surfing and all that kind of stuff. Just another way to get to experience that time on the water. And, you know, we live on the south coast at the moment in Dorset area, so there's some incredible places to go and do those water sports around there. And, you know, the Solent is just like that as well. So we're very, very lucky to live on an island and get to enjoy the water as much as we do.
Yeah, indeed. So sailgp.com presumably will be the best place to go to keep appraised of this. If you can't actually get to Cowes yourself and actually follow the whole thing, presumably you're also with SailGP on all the social media as well.
Yes, you can also watch the racing on BT Sport if you have BT Sport. And if you don't have that, then you can shortly after the live broadcast, you can catch up on Facebook, where they do a full production of the racing as well. But yeah, I mean, we can't encourage people enough. You know, watching these boats is an incredible spectacle. The race village is free, so you can enter as you wish, and it's just a short trip on the red jet to get over to the island, you know. So it'd be a spectacular day out for people, and the more people the merrier, and it'd be fantastic to be there and support the home team, and we look forward to seeing as many people as possible.
From the joys of Siren Radio and indeed Southside Broadcasting up in the north and the east Midlands, etc., we're sending our best wishes from that point of view. Hopefully, fingers crossed, well, next we speak, you'll be champions of all, which is, you know, what we're heading for, obviously, from that point of view. But for the moment, Chris Draper, Matt Gottschall, and Richard Mason, many, many thanks indeed. And hopefully, we'll speak again very soon. Take care, gentlemen.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.
Hurrah! So Gabriella Peralta, Richard Fitzwilliams, Chloe Rose, Ian Lennox, Wendy Howard, Rebecca Ash, Alex George, Dr. Alex George, Colette Wade, Dr. Eleanor, Palm Sahata, Diane James, Chris Draper, Matt Gottschall, Richard Mason, Fergus Jeffs, Emma Street. They said we couldn't do it. I don't know who they were, but we did it, Fergus, all sorted through. Did you enjoy the last packed programme of the Midweek Drive Morning Edition?
I certainly did.
Splendid. Back again for Wednesday's Midweek Drive.
Yes, I will.
Wonderful. Hopefully we'll be in some sort of set form of working through that. Don't forget, 7 o'clock this evening, we have got an awesome special. It's Sound and Country Vision with Tessa Leanne Snart, and it's Tessa's whole day she actually spent at the Dixie Fields, the first ever Dixie Fields Country Music, with a whole heap of good interviews as well with celebs from the country music scene and more. That's pretty much it. We are out of here. Happy Thursday. Only one thing to actually say, Fergus, wear sunscreen. So 1, 2, 3...
Wear sunscreen.
FM. FM.